We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Graduating from the prestigious RADA, legendary director and producer Roy Gould found himself at the heart of London's thriving West End to stage manage some of the biggest musicals in town at the time, including Billy at Theatre Royal Drury Lane with Michael Crawford, Jesus Christ Superstar at the Palace, and the original London production of Chicago at the Cambridge. Yet in 1979, he swapped theatre for the enigmatic feel of the TV studio as he joined the BBC under David Croft's Comedy Repertory Company and as a third assistant director working on various drama and sitcom. Through this, he became part of the inner circle of the David Croft franchise, rising to first assistant director of both Heidi High and Hello, Hello, and director of the David Croft sitcom classics You Rang My Lord and Oh, Dr. Beeching. I caught up with one of the most eminent directors of his generation to talk theatre, sitcom, and the magic behind a quintessential David Croft production. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Roy Gould.
Let's start at the beginning. Like so many of your peers, you attended the legendary RADA. What sort of grounding did this give you?
Unfortunately, when I went to RADA, it wasn't going through its best stage, I have to be honest with you. As a stage management student, you were there basically to build all the sets and stage manage for all the acting students. I was very lucky because I was there with some very good actors, people like Jonathan Pryce was there when I was there. Graham Seed, who became Nigel Pargeter in The Archers. You remember Nick Graham? And a few of the others, but it was a strange experience. I was only 17 when I went there. I was too young, really, and so therefore I didn't get out as much of it out as I should. But at the same time, it took me to London. It introduced me to a few people, and it started me off.
What do you think was the benefit of going to RADA when you got out into the big wide world?
Well, I'd worked with actually being on the course. I was working with some very good actors. That was the first time because I'd been a member of, you know, AmDram in Marlow, you know, an amateur dramatic group, but I'd never actually worked with professional actors or people that can become professional actors. So it taught me a lot about, you know, what to expect from them really. And also I say, because it was in London, I was a small town boy, although I was born in London. I was a small town boy, really. So it was a little bit of a shock, I'll be honest with you. But it made me grow up quite quickly. I was only 17. And so I don't think it's what RADA wanted to teach me, but that's what I got out of it.
Finding yourself in the very heart of London's thriving West End during the 70s must have been a glamorous experience. How did you feel about being in that enigmatic and theatrical world? And what do you think the international perception of the West End was like at that time?
Two things, really, is that I was very lucky when I was at RADA. I started to go around to various West End theatres to see if I could stand backstage. Most stage managers wouldn't let you. But there was one wonderful stage manager, a guy called Jimmy Gill, who was the DSM on Godspell at Wyndham's. And Jimmy used to let me stand in the wings at Wyndham's and watch the show. And every so often he would walk away from the prompt call and say, you call the next couple of bits. So that was incredible, because Jimmy was wonderful in that way. When I went back to Wyndham's a couple of years ago to actually stage manage a show, I fondly remembered that prompt corner. At that time, the West End was really, really the hub of theatre. I mean, I've never been to Broadway, so I can't talk about the States. But it really was the hub. It was buzzing, and there were great shows on at the time. You know, Jesus Christ Superstar and all these sorts of shows were fantastic shows.
Working on the biggest theatrical productions of the time, including Billy, Jesus Christ Superstar, and Chicago, how different is it to work in theatre as opposed to TV? How did you find working with some of the biggest stars in theatre, and did you have any favourites?
It's a very different business, television to theatre. I loved working on Billy at Drury Lane, not only because I loved the theatre itself, that theatre itself. I remember my parents took me to see My Fair Lady about 1960, 61, I can't remember. And I think that's probably when I fell in love with theatre, in that very theatre. So it was a thrill to me when I got the job as ASM on Billy, which was just such a thrill. I loved working with Michael Crawford. Michael has a bit of a reputation of not being the easiest guy to work for, but he's a perfectionist, and always has been. So I got on very well with Michael. Again, he was a huge star, and to be working very up front and very close with a huge star like Michael, I mean, he was at his top of his game when he was doing that show. And to hear the audience reaction from 2,500 people in the audience every night, I mean, you know, 8 shows a week, was fantastic. Superstar was a very different type of show. It was much more relaxed in the fact that you know, it was a rock opera. And the whole, there was no stars. The show was the star, really. So that was a very different thing to work on. And the great thing about Chicago was, because it has started at Sheffield, Peter James's production at Sheffield, I didn't work with it in Sheffield. I came on board when it came into the Cambridge. But again, it was a great show. There were no stars in it. There were a fantastic ensemble cast. I mean, you know, Ben Cross, Jenny Logan, Antonia Ellis, but great dancers. Again, a different experience. All three shows were very, very different types of shows. I mean, I also did Elvis at the Astoria, which was with PJ Proby, Jim Proby, and Shaking Stevens and Tim Whitnell. Again, a very different show. There were four big musicals, but there were different types of musicals. I've got to say, when I went into television, of course, you were recording stuff. I mean, we did live programs, but what we call the daily programs, things like Nationwide and Panorama, and those, you worked on those, and Blue Peter, of course. How can you forget Blue Peter? So I worked on those shows. But I think that probably the reason why I went across to situation comedy was I loved the audience reaction. And in those days, you know, we recorded in front of 300 people in the studios. And it was very immediate. The laughs were very immediate. And also the rehearsal periods were very tight. I mean, on David Croft shows, we literally rehearsed for Monday to Thursday. And then on Friday, we were in the studio. And that immediate reaction from the audience was fantastic. And I think I preferred that. I mean, I love doing the dramas and I love doing the other sorts of programs. But I think the shows with audiences, I've always loved an audience reaction.
In 1979, you swapped the West End for the confines of a studio when you joined the BBC. We'll get onto your major BBC achievements in a moment, but what sort of accomplishment was it to merely say that you worked for the corporation?
The answer to the last part of your question, what was, how did I feel about it? Stunned. I was stunned. I was so lucky. And to walk into Television Centre on a daily basis, that wonderful building, which I think it's been criminal that it's no longer there as a studio space. Apart from, I know studios 1, 2, and 3 are still there, but it was an incredible place to work, to walk around, to be in the middle of, to go into the tea bars. And there was the big Shakespeare being done in Studio 1 and a comedy being done in Studio 3 and, you know, Newsnight being done in Studio 2 or they, and just bumping into so many people of different skills, and all in one building. It was a phenomenal experience. I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, I loved it at the time, but I now, when Television Centre's gone, I realize how much I miss it. You know, frankly, because I sort of regret the day that I gave him my notice. Really, it was a difficult decision, but I had to sort of move on with my career, and I was sort of rather stuck within the BBC. But I will always regret leaving that building for the last time. And I have to say, when I went to the Light Entertainment goodbye BBC Television Centre party up on the fifth floor, it was a heartbreaking moment to me to say that it wasn't going to be there anymore as I remembered it. And to be honest with you, I can't go past on the tube without a sinking feeling in my heart, to be honest with you.
It's ironic because your podcast is going to go out a week before Josh starts an 8-week series on BBC TV Centre and the closing of it. So
he's doing really?
A lot of work about it at the moment, yeah.
Oh, but fantastic. Well, good luck with that, Josh.
Joining the BBC comedy department, you came invested into the legendary David Croft famous repertory company. What were your first impressions of him?
My first impression of him was that the man was a comedy genius. I was so lucky. And I fell into that office by complete, well, almost accident. I'd been on 3 or 4 months as the assistant floor manager on Play School, which was a sort of place you were dumped after you'd done some really good shows. They would dump you on Play School, which was the show from hell to do as an assistant floor manager, or I found it so, because I'd just done Top of the Pops and the Eurovision Song Contest at Harrogate. And so I was then dumped onto Play School to sort of bring me down to earth again. And I will always remember that I was in the bar, the BBC club, after my last recording of Play School. And I have to be honest with you, I was having a few drinks to drown my sorrows. And my dear friend Robin Carr, who was then one of the AFMs on assistant floor managers on Heidi High, came into the bar and asked me what I was doing next. And I said I didn't have any shows on my rota. So I'd have to go in on the Monday to find out what I was meant to be doing next. And he said, well, why don't you join David's office with me? Be the second assistant floor manager, and looking after the props and the cast for the upcoming, series. And that's how I joined David's office. On the next Monday, I joined the office when they were actually rehearsing the pilot episode of Allo Allo. So I didn't meet David on the Monday. I met David on the Tuesday, which was his 60th birthday, because they had a surprise party for David. David loved having parties on birthdays. He enjoyed that whole camaraderie, which was fantastic. So the one people that us in the office went down to act and rehearsal rooms and hid from him during a coffee break, and then all jumped out and said surprise, and the champagne popped. And he looked at me because he'd never met me, and he said, "Who are you?" And I told him, and he said, "Well, welcome to the Croft Empire." And I didn't sort of leave after that. And I loved David. He was a great, great man. He was my mentor. Not that he ever actually took me to one side and said, this is how you do things. That wasn't David's way at all. You learnt by being in the room with him. You learnt by listening to him. You learnt by reading the scripts. I was very, very, very lucky because, you know, the shows I worked on, I was with his production secretary. We were the first people to hear or read the scripts as they came in, because David wrote them in longhand and put them into a dictaphone. So the PA, Bernadette Darnell, was there at the time, would be typing up the script from the dictaphone, and I'd be listening at the same time, and I'd be doing all the prop lists as it was coming in. So to be the first to hear what those shows that became iconic shows was, yeah, well, that's a great thrill. Great thrill.
But obviously that golden age was spearheaded by just one guy. What was it like working in Bill Cotton's legendary light entertainment department? In your opinion, how significant is Bill Cotton in the story of British light entertainment?
How significant is Bill in the story of light entertainment? Well, he was BBC Light Entertainment, really. He was a larger than life character, Bill, and he could be tough. In fact, he could be very tough, but he also could be absolutely charming. And he knew the business inside out. He knew light entertainment business inside out, and the stars that he brought in, people like Dave Allen and all people like that, they respected Bill. And you needed that because they knew that he knew what he was talking about. Yes, he could be a tough negotiator. I'm sure the agents probably hated him at times, but he knew what he wanted, and he also knew what a good show was. He knew how to put a show together. You know, people forget that things like the Generation Game, although that it came from another country, it was completely remodeled by Bill. You know, totally remodeled. And he made the successes. He made the Val Doonigans of this world. He made the Dave Allens, and the Morecambe and Wises, of course. You know, he believed in Eric and Ernie, where a lot of people didn't. But he knew that if he could get the chemistry right, and the genius was getting Eddie Bayman in to write scripts, was that he could make the magic work. And that was the great thing about Bill. I say he could be a tough man to work for. He could get quite grumpy. I remember being in a meeting when Top of the Pops was getting a bit lax, and we were all called in. The entertainment was all called in, and he took us all to task and saying the show's getting lazy, the show's getting tired. He basically gave us all a big kick up the bum. Well, the producers big kick up the bum. I was only a junior, but I was also in on the meeting. So he was a hard taskmaster, but he knew what he wanted, and well, he made BBC Light Entertainment. Let's be honest.
Josh wrote a biographical drama of Bill Cotton when he was at uni, so he knows that era of entertainment very well.
right. Funny enough, Josh, is that when we did the David Croft This Is Your Life, I didn't know it at the time, but I was also on the set. I didn't know I was going to be on the set, and I was sitting behind Anne Croft next to Bill. On the set of and I just before they started recording, I said to Bill, "Oh, what was the last This Is Your Life you did, Bill?" And he said, "My own."
In terms of sitcom, Heidi High remains unique in creating a repertory company who enjoyed success with three separate sitcoms. In hindsight, how did the audience benefit from the trilogy of perfectly defined character comedy, which was associated with a definite group of fellow actors?
There were two schools of thought with that. I mean, I thought it worked brilliantly well, and obviously David did too. I think some of the younger people within the comedy department, I know, in fact, because we had conversations saying, why is David using the same people again? And it was a case of, it just worked, and that's, the chemistry worked. I think the chemistry worked best, I have to be honest, on Heidi High itself. I mean, it was a great, Heidi High was a great, great show. And it was, excuse me, it was a great, great show. And I think, you know, to work on it was a great privilege to me. As far as with Urangma Law is concerned, is that because we were a 50 minute show as opposed to a 30 minute show, the pace was different, and also they performed differently. I mean, when I took over as director on the show, it's one of the things I noticed is that we could calm everything down, which, and especially with people like Paul Shane, because Paul was a club comic, And given his head, he would go hell for leather in that club comic way, and so would need to be brought down. I don't mean it's rudely. I mean, I loved Paul a lot, but you know, that a bit subtler with performance, and the same with Sue. I mean, but we had the time to do it. So although they were the same actors, because of the time frame, it was different. It was, you know, one could work it in a different way. Dr. Beaton was a different show altogether. I think it suffered from not being allowed to get into its stride, sadly. And quite a lot of people said to me, oh, it's because you're using the same people again. And I said, no, I don't think it is that. I think it's just that we only did two series, and we were thrown about the schedules like mad. And so the audience didn't get to know the new characters that Paul and Sue and Jeff play, which was a great shame, actually, because I think that had we gone to series three, we would have then start up and running. I think the stories were going to get better and stronger and play more with the characters. But I think that was a great shame. But I mean, I believed in the repertory company that David had. I thought it worked really, really well. They were lovely. They were a lovely bunch to work with.
I had my in
Josh tried to interview Sue Pollard and it was hilarious, but it wasn't really an interview.
Well, it wouldn't be Josh with Sue. I mean, she just takes over. I mean, I love her to bits. But you don't get a word in edgeways.
You became first assistant director on the David Croft and Jeremy Lloyd classic LOLO. As he did so triumphantly for Dad's Army, David Croft chose to set the sitcom in a specific time in history. How significant is this in the enduring nature of the sitcom?
I think what was clever about David was that all his shows were set in the past, which means they never dated. Which I know that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but actually they have never dated. You can still play them. Allo Allo was an interesting show. I mean, it actually. What we tend to forget now was how on the edge that was, how dangerous that show was. I mean, there were a lot of people that were totally against it. I mean, you know, including very high ups within the BBC who said, you can't take the Mickey out of the war. You can't do that. So I think it was a balancing act that David and Jeremy did. I mean, I think it was just fantastic. It was just so funny. You know, and working on the first series was just amazing. Well, working on every series of it was incredible. We just don't make those sorts of shows anymore, which actually I think is a great shame. It was full all out farce, and to do farce on television is almost impossible, but somehow they did it. And we know it was farce, it was cartoon. Although it was based around a real world of war, I think it was very cleverly done, is that everybody was taking the Mickey out of. So we were all buffoons in our own ways, which of course war is. So I think it was always a show that I loved, and it was great fun to work on. It didn't have the depth of David and Jimmy's shows. It was a completely different sort of show. Say it was cartoon. It was very much on the surface, but that a lot of that came from Jeremy, who, I mean, I know when I remember when we were at Elstree and they had to write two episodes very quickly. So Jeremy came into the office next door to my office, and him and David sat in the office for 2 days writing two episodes. And I remember saying to David afterwards, I said, you know, all you could hear was laughter, and especially Jeremy's laughter. Excuse me. especially Jeremy's laughter. And David's, and I said, how does it work on this show? And he said, well, Jeremy does about 10 gags a page and I edit it down to two or three. But that wasn't the way that he worked with Jim. Because Jimmy and David mostly never sat in the same room writing together. They would do an outline of the series, but they would alternate. They would play tennis with the scripts. Sorry, did that answer your question, Josh? Sorry.
Yeah. Like so many sitcoms from this era, the contentious issue of sex is a constant theme throughout. Why do you think sexual lust and frustration are at the heart of so many David Croft sitcoms?
Because he thought that's the way the world went round. David's thought. He actually said that to me one of our makeup designers went in there. She'd never worked on David shows before, and she tried to change the hairstyles to the real period hairstyles on Heidi High, and David came into the makeup room and said, no, that's wrong. That's wrong. They said, well, it's period. It's absolutely right. He said, I don't care about the period. They don't look sexy. And he said, you know, the whole point of the yellow coat girls is they're there to look sexy. I mean, I know that's very much of its period, but that was why the girls were there in their short shorts and long legs, you know, Nikki Kelly with her long legs and Ricky Howard. You know, and that was all part of the fun. And it was innocent fun. I mean, I know people object to it nowadays, but nothing was meant by it. It was just fun. It was like the Carry-Ons, really. You know, I know you're not allowed to wolf whistle anymore in the street and all that stuff, sort of stuff. But David was, you know, of his era, as am I. You know, I'm younger, but, you know, that's what I grew up with too. So, things move on. Let's put it that way. But I think that of his era, and funnily enough, although you know the BBC may not put things on their mainstream channels, they still sell the DVDs and they still put them on UK Gold.
In 1988, you were chosen to direct the latest incarnation of the Croft and Perry trilogy, Euranmylord, which satirised the 1920s class system. Pushing sitcom boundaries and elongating each episode from the standard 30-minute slot to 50, how did this encourage more scope for storytelling?
Expanding the show, it slowed the pace down, which gave more room for more character study within the show, as opposed to just chasing the laughs. Excuse me, I need to stop a second. Oh, got a runny nose. It slowed them down, so therefore gave more for character studies. Unlike with Heidi High, where you had 30 minutes and you needed to get your comedy in quickly, at least we had a chance to slow everything down and to build up the atmosphere, and also use the set. Because on Euran, we had this big composite set that we built in Elstree, in the big studio at Elstree Studios. Which was great and as a director, although obviously the downstairs wasn't downstairs, it was along the side, but it meant you could keep things moving a lot. You could walk down corridors, you could enter rooms. Whereas on Heidi High, you didn't have that space to do it. I think probably now, to be absolutely frank with you, is that the pace is probably a bit slow when I've gone back to look at the tapes. And I would want to, you know, edit them down a bit. But it was very much trying to make a drama, make it look and feel more like a drama. Mm. And David is quoted as saying, and I believe him saying that it was his favourite show that he did.
Do you think there were some people at the beginning who believed it was like a remake of Upstairs Downstairs?
Yes, they did. But that's what David and Jim were taking the mickey out of, in a way. But at the same time, is that they experienced that life. David had, you know, there were servants in David's house when he first started. And I think, I can't remember where one of Jimmy's relations was a downstairs maid. So it was something they knew about.
Your directing credits continued, and in 1995, you directed the final David Croft sitcom, Oh, Dr. Beeching. I love this show, from the spatial set, heartwarming characters who you really believed in, and the obvious touches of Croft magic. However, why do you think the series isn't as fondly remembered as Heidi High? And as director of a sitcom, how responsible are you for the overall execution of it?
Firstly, why wasn't it as popular? It wasn't as popular because I don't think it was given a chance. For two reasons. One, the comedy department at the BBC was changing and a new head of comedy had come in Geoffrey Perkins, and I knew Geoffrey. But Geoffrey wanted to change the look and style of what was happening in the comedy department. He wasn't a great fan of studio shows. He wanted to go more into the filmic route. So we had a bit of a fight there with Geoffrey about the show. He wasn't mad about that sort of show anymore. He appreciated what David had done over the years, but he wanted to change how the thought of what was happening within comedy. Therefore, we weren't given a big chance to prove ourselves. Unfortunately, we fell into a trap of scheduling, especially in series two, where we were going against Wimbledon and Tim Henman was going through and going through. And unfortunately, Tim Henman's matches were being played until about 10 o'clock at night. And on the nights that we were meant to be going out, and a couple of times we went out at 10:30 at night, which is not a great time for a broad situation comedy show. And we were being moved all over the place. So the audience didn't know where to find us. And David was always a great believer, and so am I, is that people want a time to view. They need a timetable to lock in. Now, I know things are changing now with streaming and whatever, and the youngsters sort of choose their own schedules. But at that time, people really wanted to know that this is the time for that, and this time for that, and that time for that. But it was all over the place. And as I say, because we weren't getting a full backup by the department. And as I don't mean this rudely against Geoffrey, it's just that's what he wanted to do. So therefore, when we weren't getting the figures, and we weren't getting the figures because they didn't know where to find us, is that we weren't getting the backup. And so in the end, the controllers said, that's enough. But it was a great, great shame, because I think that had we gone to series three, we could have really opened up the show. I loved directing it. It gave me such a thrill. I mean, I have to be honest with you, when I went round with my production manager, Charles, and we were looking for the location, and we travelled all over the country to find the right station. When I came across Arley Station, and when we drove over that bridge for the first time and I looked down, I just knew that we'd found the location. It was absolute joy. And of course, I don't know how many people know this, but we built the houses on that set. The houses didn't exist. We built the frontages because the cottages that they all came out of. But it all worked such a treat. It just looked so great in the Severn Valley. It just was, and as a director, I mean, although David tutted at me a few times because he wasn't one for establishing shots and crane shots, he liked to go straight into the comedy. But I did talk him into letting me have these sort of crane shots at the beginning of the episodes to show the place and show the trains coming in, to give a vista. I say, David used to tuck and say, how much longer are you going to take doing this? When do we get the funny stuff? But it was a great, it was a great joy to shoot. I mean, I'd say to have a camera crane and coming off that wonderful scenery and a steam train coming towards you and being able to play about with that. I mean, it was like, it was boys playing with steam train toys. It was lovely. Great fun.
Josh is saying he's got to say it's one of his favourite sitcoms of all time, and he's watched a few. So,
well, I'm very pleased to hear it, Josh. I was very proud of it. I was very, very proud of it. I mean, you know, I loved playing with it. It was great fun. And in fact, you know, we had such fun. I mean, to have people like Stephen Lewis, and Stephen was just great fun. We had, you know, Hugh Lloyd. Eli Woods, apart from our normal people. I mean, lovely, great acts and very funny people. I mean, I was like, you know, so, and we had a great crew. I mean, my camera crew and my lighting and sound crew were people we'd all worked with in the studio. I'd all worked with in the studio and we all got on like a house on fire. And of course, we did with the cast because we were all a team, which, I mean, I know it's a cliche, but we were a family, and it was just a great show to work on. And I was really, really sad when we didn't get Series 3. Really sad.
What is David Croft's legacy on British comedy?
He is British comedy. David was British comedy. I mean, yes, I think obviously people like John Sullivan came through, and he was a great admirer of John's. Totally. But I think sitcom, I think before David started with Dad's Army, it was very much like Bing Bong Darling I'm Home. It was very much that sort of Terry and June, which I'm not knocking Terry and June. It had its audiences, but it was very much that, you know, sofa and curtains. And I think, I mean, again, we tend to forget how much David was breaking the mold with Dad's Army. I mean, really was. I mean, nothing had been. I mean, yes, there was the army game back in the late 50s, but he really was pushing the envelope. I think with Dad's, but so we forget that now because things have moved on. But it was a very brave move, and also he loved filming. I mean, you know, on Dad's they would go away filming for 3 or 4 weeks, as we did on Heidi High and Hello, Hello, because he always like the thought of taking it out of the studio. He loved studio audiences and he needed that studio part, but he also loved opening it out and playing with the countryside and, you know, playing with the locations. And he also believed it gave a very good, company spirit to go away. He would never shoot in London. We always went out of pre M25, but we always went out of the M25, you know, to Norfolk or to down to Hampshire or wherever. So we were all away in, you know, unit hotels, and we would get together in the evenings and have a drink and go for a meal. So there was a big camaraderie. And that was again, very, very new, even within, because I say what they liked was, you know, Terry and June, they were going down the road and shooting a, you know, a suburban street, you know, for one day or for a couple of days for a whole series. You know, it'd be a 2 or 3 day shoot, but David would go away for 3 or 4 weeks to shoot.
I've missed a little bit of that, Josh. You found a letter from Michael Gray that was sent. There was a letter from Michael Gray when he worked for the Great Organization about Clive Dunn being in the show. And they wanted Clive Dunn to be the star of the show, not Arthur Lowe.
That's right. Yes, I believe that did happen, did exist. Clive was well known at that time. I mean, yes, Arthur was known for as Mr. Swindley in Coronation Street. I think there were lots of negotiations. Michael was a very shrewd negotiator. So it doesn't surprise me in any way, shape or form. Just very quickly, as you touched on Michael, Josh, is that, when we were doing Hello, Hello, and I remember being in the office one morning, and it was about, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning, and the phone rang in the office, and I answered it, and it was Michael, when he was controller of BBC One. And he said, is David in yet? And I said, no, Michael, he won't be in until much later. And he said, will you just pass on a message? And I said, yes, of course. And he said, will you tell him that I was doing the show? I was sitting at home last night in my kitchen with the kitchen table, and I had the schedules all over my table. He said, and I was getting myself into a dreadful mess because I couldn't, it's how I scheduled what with what. And he said, I decided just to take a break, and I turned on the television. He said, and Hello, Hello came on. And he said, I just want you to tell David that it was the funniest half hour I spent. And then I solved all the schedule problems. And I said, I'll pass that message on. True story.
Did he know it was on? Because as director, he should have known, surely.
Yes, he should have known. I don't know, to be honest with you. It was. I expect he did. And I expect that he was probably, but I have to say it was just a big surprise. I wasn't expecting and say to suddenly have the controller of BBC One phoning the office at that time of the morning. But I think that was where Michael's great skill was. He was a great communicator and he was a great champion of people. I mean, up until that point, you'd never get channel controllers coming down on the studio floor. They just didn't. I don't think they knew where the studios were, to be honest with you. But Michael would always come down. Michael will always come down. I mean, you know, all of a sudden you turn around and there was Michael Gray. I mean, just a quick story away from Croft. When I was production managing the first series of French and Saunders, and the girls had written a sketch saying, Jennifer falls through door into Michael Gray's office. There is Michael Gray. And Jeff Posner, who was the producer, said, can we get Grade? And I said, I don't know. Well, do you want to phone him up? And he said, no, you phone him up. So I rang the office, and the gatekeeper into Michael's office was a lady called Queenie. And Queenie was Bill Cotton's secretary. And Bill had bequeathed Queenie to Michael when he took over as controller. Queenie was, she was a very strong, you didn't get past Queenie. You just didn't. She was the sentinel at the gate. So I was psyching myself to make this phone call to Michael's office. And I'm going to get Queenie. And, oh, God, how do I get past her to get to Michael to ask this question? And just by pure fluke, Queenie wasn't in that day. And Michael answered the phone himself. And he said, you're right. I said, I'm just surprised I didn't get Queenie, Michael. And he said, ah, no, she's off today. So it's your lucky day. You're fine. How can I help you? Yeah. And I said, well, French and Saunders, who you know, and he said, yes. So they've written a sketch and one part is that Jennifer falls through this door at television centre into your office. And there you are. He said, am I wearing my braces and smoking a big cigar? And I said, yes, Michael. He said, when do you want me? And I said, well, I think it was something like Tuesday afternoon about 3 o'clock. Can you get down to Studio 3? And he said, yes. Can you send me the script? I said, yes, of course I'll send you the script. He said, I'll be there. And he was. You know, that was Michael Gray.
Yeah.
In 2003, you directed the ITV comedy drama Booze Cruise. With an all-star cast, including Brian Murphy, Neil Pearson and Mark Benton, how difficult was it to execute while managing big personalities? And why do you think it remains a cult classic?
First of all, I produced Booze Cruise. I was the producer of Booze Cruise, which, just a very quick story, Josh, is that that was another fluke of my career, because I'd left the BBC and I had a four sitcom development deal with Yorkshire Television, because I knew the head of comedy at and drama at Yorkshire, David Reynolds. And David had given me for my company this four sitcom option deal. And I used three of them and we hadn't got anything away and I couldn't find another show. I couldn't find another script. And so I arranged to meet with David in all of the classy places, Groucho's, basically to say, I can't find a fourth show. I'll give you the option for the fourth show back. Although he didn't pay me any money at that point, I won't be using the final tranche of money. And just before I went to that meeting, I went to go and see two writer friends of mine, Paul Minette and Brian Levison. And Paul and Brian had been writing at LWT for Russ Abbott, and they did a couple of sitcoms there. And I knew Paul and Brian very well, and they'd written two episodes for David of Dr. Beeching, because I'd recommended them to David and he was looking for other writers to do a couple of episodes. And I thought Paul and Brian would fit in, and they did indeed. And I was just talking to the boys in their office, and Paul just came out with this saying, oh, he'd been away the weekend before on this booze cruise. And he lived in just outside Sevenoaks in Kent. And he said, it's very odd, because this bloke knocked on the door I'd never met off the estate and said, we're just trying to get a van load of people to go on this booze cruise because my daughter's getting married. And so I want to go, but if we can get a few people, it'll save costs on getting a van going over there. And that's what they did. And that was all, it was a strange conversation. And at the end of this cup of coffee in Groucho's, and I was about to stand up and take my leave of David. And I suddenly turned around and said, what about a bunch of guys that go on this booze cruise? And David said, what? And I said, it's not an idea. It's just something that Paul and Brian were talking to me about this morning. Is there something in a comedy drama about a bunch of guys who go on a booze cruise? And David said, that's your last option. Who are you writing? I said, well, get Paul and Brian. And that's how it started. That's how that idea started. And I went back to the boys that afternoon and said, right, lads, you've got $5,000 to put a treatment together about this. And we went across to France. We saw the locations. And had ideas, and they put it together. They wrote very much for characters like I like to do, is that they had actors in their mind, because Brian knew Neil Pearson a bit, because he's a Spurs supporter, and Brian's a Spurs supporter, so he'd met Neil a couple of times, and he said, well, one of the characters is sort of like a Neil Pearson character. I said, well, don't think it's a meaningful thing. We'll try, if write the character, and we'll try and get Neil. excuse me. And he said, well, another character is sort of like a Tim Spall character. I said, well, Tim's probably, too old now, blah, blah. And we went through, and somebody else mentioned Mark Benton. Right. And then it came up the part that dear Brian Murphy played. And, we're going, well, who can we get? Who's really funny? And I'd worked with Brian many, many years before in Rep Theatre. And he was an absolutely lovely, lovely man when he was at his top of his fame doing, Man About the House and those shows with Uther. And I said, well, let's see if we can get Brian. We'd already got Martin Clunes, because the whole, I'll backtrack a bit, is that ITV bought the film on the back of us getting Martin. They said, if you can get a star in there, we'll do it. It took me 3 years to get it through ITV. And Martin read the script and said he would come on board, which was great. So therefore we had a star, which ITV recognised as a star. So we had him. But with Brian, and unfortunately we had no money left in the kitty because the negotiations had been done and we had no money left in the kitty to get Brian. And so I phoned his agent, who I had dealings with before, a lovely guy called Bryn. And I said to Bryn, I said, it's awful to ask you this, but see if we can get to Brian, but we can't pay him very much. And Bryn said, well, let me have the script. Well, send the script straight to Brian. And he did. And within a day, Brian had come back to us saying he'd do it, you know, and which was fantastic. I mean, Murphy's just one of the nicest men in the business. And it was a great, great time filming. I mean, we shot very little in France. In fact, we shot most of France in England. But it was great fun because I'd never worked with people like Neil Pearson before. I'd never met with Mark. With Martin, and it was just, we knew the script was good. We just knew that we had something there, and it was very, very odd because I remember the day after the first film went out, I was actually in a hotel bar with David Reynolds, the executive producer from Yorkshire. And we were waiting for the figures to come through. And he said to me, he said, well, what sort of figure do you think will be a good figure that we get, you know, for last night's, viewing figures? I said, well, if we get 5 million, that would be great, wouldn't it, David? And he said, yes, that would be terrific. And then his phone rang and it was his secretary. And I was sitting opposite him and he was just doing lots of ahas. Uh-huhs, uh-huhs in the phone. And I thought, oh, here we go. And he said, how many do you say? I said, 5 million. He said, 9.4 million, which will be up with the video recorded to about 10.5. We broke every record. We were the highest rating single drama on British television for 2 years, which was quite amazing. The audiences just loved it. They loved the characters. It was different. Funnily enough, my fight with ITV for 3 years was they kept on saying that single film comedies don't work on ITV. And I kept on arguing, yes, they do. And we only got it away by pure fluke because the head of comedy was off on maternity leave. And somebody I knew was sitting in her seat for 6 months. And he'd read the script the year before. And so when he sat in his seat, he rang me up and said, is that Booze Cruise film script still around? And I said, yes. He said, get me another copy. Send me another copy over now. And he reread it and he took it straight to the channel controllers and said, this will be stonking as a bank holiday film. And he wasn't wrong. Mm-hmm. He wasn't wrong.
What might a good
as a director, what makes a good comedy script?
Impossible to answer that one, to be honest with you. You just know when you see it. You just know when you start to read it. I mean, I've read a lot of scripts and I've kissed a lot of frogs. when I left the BBC, this David Reynolds, he gave me a job as comedy consultant for Yorkshire, which is why I got that deal, on the Booze Cruise. And I would have scripts sent straight to my house. Comedy script sent to my house, and my poor postman, I think, must have had a double hernia because they were coming in box loads once, you know, and in the 2 years I was his comedy consultant, I found two scripts that were worth doing. Unfortunately, a lot of people think they can write comedy and they can't. Now, it's not their fault. It's just that they just don't have funny bones. And it's very odd. You just know, you open up the first page and you start to read and you know whether somebody's a good writer. But you think actually they're a good writer, but they can't write comedy. I mean, they should be very good drama writers, but they don't have that funny one. But other, you just open up and you just know from word go that this person knows how to write comedy. I can't tell you. I just don't know. It's just instinctive.
Beyond sitcom, you've also turned your hand to novel writing. And in 2021, you released The Secrets of a Small Village. What were the elements of TV sitcom you were able to draw from in order to make the story your own?
Just about everything is the answer to the story. Just about everything. Funny enough, the book started off as an idea for a screenplay. And I started, I don't write treatments. I'm not into treatment. I get ideas in my head and I sort of turn them over in my head for a couple of months and then I sit down and start to write very much as a sort of, stream of consciousness. And I kept thinking that I'd been to a village in Norfolk. I live in Norwich and I'd been up, and I saw this village and I'd had an idea for this very strange, well, it was originally a market town idea of where these strange things happen. And there are people that are suddenly found dead. I'm sorry. It's not a great idea for comedy, but there you go. And then I went to this, I drove through this village and I thought, wait a minute. It's not a market town. It's a village. It's a hamlet where nobody goes. And so my brain started to work and I thought it's a screenplay. And then as I started to sit down to start writing the screenplay, I suddenly realized it wasn't a screenplay at all. It was a novel. Now I'd never written a novel before and I didn't know if I could write a novel. I had no idea if I'd write a novel. But what I found and an answer to the question really is that I can't draw to save my life. I cannot draw to save my life. But what I can do is I can see, I can direct in my head. Any book I read, any script I read, I am directing it in my head. And so when I was writing it, I was directing it in my head. So I can see, it's like I can see all the shots in the book. And so I think my television experience of being a multi-camera television director, it really helped me because I knew when I was cutting from scene to scene, as if I was writing a television piece, my chapters, if you look at the novel, it's very much written in chapters, which are basically episodes. And that's what I did really. I mean, even with my second novel, which I'm just about to get published now, is that I had to force myself to write more descriptive stuff, to pack it out more. Otherwise, I was more scripting it than anything else to make it more of a novel, really.
Yeah.
Looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
What's my proudest achievement? I think it has to be working for David Croft. I think it has to be. The man was a genius. I was very fortunate to work on his shows. And as I said earlier, is that David was my mentor. He never sat me down. He never said, this, you do this, you do that. But to be in the same room as this man and saw how he worked and to see those scripts and see how they were structured. I mean, I remember actually, funnily enough, I remember saying to David one day, I've sussed out how you structure a script. He said, oh, have you? Can you tell me how I do it? Because I am the slightest idea. And he meant it. He wasn't being disingenuous. He meant it.
Yeah.
He was an instinctive writer. And I think what I was very lucky is that's what I picked up, you know, talking about writing my novels and writing other things is that I've now become quite an instinctive writer. But I think that comes from working with Croft. I don't think I had that before I worked with David. at all. So my greatest thing was working for David. I mean, it was fantastic to work in the West End with big stars and these wonderful West End theatres. That was great. But I think working for David Croft was the pinnacle.
And then finally, what's next for Roy Gould?
What's next for Roy Gould? Well, I've got my second novel being published at the end of May this year, which is I'm very excited about. That's about a second-rate theatre company in the Second World War that go off to the East Coast to entertain people, and they're a disparate bunch. I won't give anything away, but lots of things happen to them. And it's a historical novel. Hopefully it's funny, and also it's tragic at the same time. I have to be honest with you, I'm very proud of it, and I hope I've got, you know, fingers crossed for it. I'm also writing at the moment, which may be interesting, is that when we finished You Rang My Lord, I don't know if you remember, at the end, the last shots is Jeff and Sue walking down the beach at Cromer, and they're going to open a boarding house. And that image stuck with me. And I remember saying to David after we finished making the series, I said, is there a spin-off series about James and Ivy and a boarding house? Rather like they did with Upstairs, Downstairs, with Thomas and Sarah, with John Alderton I've got John's wife's name. And he said, no, I don't think so, love. He said, but if you want to do it. So Robin Kai and I wrote a treatment that we took into the BBC, and they didn't want it, unfortunately. So it went into a draw. Literally at the end of last year, I was called by a publishers in Hungary, who are producing a coffee table book about You Rang My Lord. Because I don't know if you know, You Rang My Lord is huge in Hungary. Absolutely enormous. It's dubbed, but it's absolutely huge. I was asked to go over about just before COVID to go over there with Jeff and Sue and a couple of the others. I couldn't make it, unfortunately. And they were treated like royalty over there. I think they show it every day. It's dubbed, but and it's huge. And there was a coffee table book that was produced in this country by, I can't remember who the authors were, about Urang and Heidi High. And funnily enough, this treatment that Robin and I had written about the James and Ivy had made its way into the book. I obviously gave permission. I couldn't remember, to be honest with you. But this publisher in Hungary, sorry, it's a very long story. This publisher in Hungary had picked up and wanted to do a coffee table book about You Rang My Lord, obviously in Hungarian. And could he use the treatment? You know, could he use that? And I said, yes, I got permission from the Croft estate, who I know very well, just to make sure that they were still happy with that. And it got me thinking about the James and Ivy stories again. And so I took the original one out of the drawer and had a look at it. And I'm literally on my last five or six pages of writing the last of the six stories based on these characters. They are, you know, throw stories. They're short stories, which I've got permission from the Croft estate, Croft and Perry estate to do. And these publishers in Hungary want to publish in Hungarian. So I'm just finished. James and Ivy, the James and Ivy stories, Boarding House by the Sea. Once I finish this podcast with you today, Josh, I've got to finish the last five or six pages to get it off to the publisher. So that's what I'm doing next. It's very exciting. I mean, as I say, I can't read Hungarian, and I'll be interested to see, what they do with it. I won't know if they get it right or not. But I'm hoping that if I can get that done, I don't know if I'll get an English publisher for it, because, you know, they've not repeated Urang in England, sadly, in the UK, sadly. So I don't think I'll be going to, unless I go to crowdfunding or something like that to get it published. But I'd like to get it published. I'm very proud of the stories.
You may...
Do you think it'll make a TV sitcom?
Well, we can't use the cast now because I'm hoping to do audio version of it, and Jeff and Sue and Perry Benson have said yes. I say they're old mates, so I've been in touch with them. So once I've got them all written and sorted out the Hungarian deal, I'm hoping to get an audio company interested, and so I can use Jeff and Sue obviously sound wise and adapt them into sort of half dramatized versions of the books, of the stories. That's what I'd like to. I can't do A, it would be too expensive. B, I mean, God bless them. Jeff and Sue are now too old to play those parts as they did. But I say audio wise. So if I can get an audio company interested, I will certainly do so.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.